The NCAA men's basketball tournament begins in earnest today, and St. John's will be among the teams taking the floor. It will be the Red Storm's first tournament game in 9 years. They've got a new head coach, and the new head coach has a new advisor, or rather an old and wise advisor. NPR's Mike Pesca talked to 74-year-old Gene Cady, the legendary Purdue coach who's bringing his insight to a new school.
A brisk March night in Queens, New York, and St. John's is doing what a nationally ranked team should do against the Big East Conference's last place squad. They are dismantling DePaul. As the season's first sellout crowd screams, an older man sits on the team bench, squints at the scoreboard, and takes notes, copious notes. Who is this man who scribbles as Dwight Hardy dribbles? This amanuensis of zone defenses. This is how St. John's head coach Steve Lavin describes him.
Our players understand he's a basketball oracle. He's a Mr. Miyagi. He is a basketball Buddha.
He is Gene Cady, winner of 6 National Coach of the Year awards, 6 Big Ten titles with Purdue, nearly 900 college, junior college, and international games. But to Steve Lavin, Cady's worth is incalculable.
Other than my mother and father, you know, Gene Cady's been the most influential person in my life.
Cady gave Lavin his first job as a graduate assistant 23 years ago at Purdue. After a successful stint as UCLA's head coach, followed by a move into broadcasting, it was time for the protege to return the favor. Cady remembers the conversation.
Well, he had talked to me about it, but when he was still working for ESPN, if a job ever opened that he liked, he thought he wanted to get back into coaching. And I said he was crazy because he's such a good TV analyst. And my wife said, now you go back and tell him that you'll help him if he wants you someday. I called him back and said, keep your dreams alive. And that's when I got interested, but I didn't dream he was going to get this job.
Pat Cady, who gave that advice, died in 2009. Cady's daughter, Lisa, had passed away some years earlier. So here was Cady, sharp, tenacious, but in a new life circumstance. The offer was still on the table. Move from West Lafayette, Indiana to Queens. Live in a hotel. Oh, and arrange a place for his toy poodle, Queenie. Cady agreed to all of that, but he also had to adapt to a new role.
I can't talk directly to the players as far as coaching technique and stuff. I have to be kind of a consultant to the coaches.
The NCAA limits the number of assistant coaches a team can have, so Cady is officially an advisor. This is why he takes so many notes. He collects his insights and passes them on to coaches later. He cannot talk to players in huddles during timeouts. He cannot walk over to a player during drills and correct footwork. But that doesn't mean Cady's presence isn't felt in practice by players like St. John's forward Justin Burrell.
His accent is strong. He'll always be like, what is that? Oh, something like that. It's one of the best things ever to hear him yell.
What is that?
The advice screamed or whispered into a head coach's ear has helped St. John's achieve a 12-6 record in the Big East after consecutive 6-12 finishes. And while every team preaches the mantra of family, St. John's is a program with the grandfatherly Cady, energetic assistant coach Rico Hines, who captained Steve Lavin's UCLA teams, and between them, the slick but substantial Lavin himself.
It's just a wonderful security blanket to know on my left is Gene Cady, you know, the person that opened the door for me 23 years ago, and on the right is Rico Hines, my very first recruit.
Cady already describes this year at St. John's as a pinnacle of his career. If the Red Storm win a few games in the tournament, it will be great, and if not, it won't be so bad. Cady will have lots of notes to review in the offseason, and he can finally do so in the company of his poodle, Queenie. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
Global stock markets have been tumbling because of the ongoing nuclear crisis in Japan. Then there's the trouble in the Middle East and rising gas prices. To sort out what's going on in the markets and what investors are saying about the economy, we call David Wessel. He's the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Linda.
Let's start with stock markets. Japan's market has crashed. Stocks are also down sharply in the U.S. and Europe. How nervous are investors?
Well, I think, of course, we have to recognize this is a human tragedy, the loss of life, the destruction of communities, all this radiation scare. That really can't be measured in dollars and cents. But I think what the markets are telling us is, wow, this is scary. We don't really know what's going to happen with the nukes in Japan. And uncertainty is never good for stock markets in the first place. But especially with all that's going on with oil prices, this has just been one big blow to people's confidence that the world economy is going to keep going and be getting better and better, which had been the case before this.
Now, also today, Japan's currency skyrocketed to an all-time high against the dollar. At one point, it was about 76 yen to the dollar. Shouldn't that also be falling, given the troubles the country's having?
Yeah, that really is an interesting phenomenon. Basically, Japan is a big supplier of savings to the rest of the world, and a lot of people have been using the yen to do sophisticated trades. But this episode seems to have brought a lot of the money home and has people trying to buy yen to close out various positions. That's driving up the value of the yen, at least temporarily. The Japanese Central Bank is trying to resist it by printing lots of yen. And most of the economists to whom I speak think this isn't going to be a long-lived phenomenon, but it's a worry for the Japanese. It makes it harder for the plants that are operating to keep exporting. And it does illustrate one issue. If Japan is going to use more of its savings to rebuild itself after this disaster, it'll, of course, have less to lend to the United States, which means we'll either have to save more or pay higher interest rates.
Japan's economy has been in the doldrums for years. Still, it is critical to some industries like cars and electronics. So will this crisis affect the world economy?
Yes, it's still a big economy, although it represents 6% of the world economy. China has become bigger than Japan. It makes a number of critical components in autos and computer chips, and so they'll have to have some supply response there. Someone else will have to make those things if we're going to get them. I think, as I said, the shock to confidence is the greatest, but I think also it's just we don't really know because we don't know how bad this nuclear thing will be. I know tonight at our time, the finance ministers and central bankers around the world are going to have a big conference call to begin to talk about whether there's something they need to do in order to protect the world economy and help Japan.
David, often some kind of a disaster can be a big hit to an economy initially, but then there's a sort of a bounce back after hurricanes, for example, when rebuilding goes on. Do you think Japan is going to bounce back?
Well, I think initially people thought this is kind of like the Kobe earthquake in 1995, when Japan bounced back much more quickly than pessimists had expected and the rebuilding went much better. Rich, resilient country. Evidence is that rich countries come back sooner from these disasters, but this really is unprecedented. And until we know how much of Japan may be uninhabitable, how long it'll be before they can learn how to deal with the radiation, I think it's premature. But the thing we've learned is that in the last week, this has turned into a much, much more serious economic problem and environmental problem for Japan, and that suggests that the effects will be much longer lived, the bad effects, than we thought just a few days ago when it looked like it would be more like the Kobe quake.
David Wessel is the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
In Japan, memorial ceremonies are being held for the thousands of people killed in the earthquake and tsunami. This is a time when people traditionally turn to religion as a source of comfort. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty explores the faith of Japan at a time of crisis.
Earlier this week, the governor of Tokyo, Shintaro Ishihara, made this startling statement.
The Japanese people must take advantage of this tsunami to wash away their selfish greed. I really do think this is divine punishment.
He later apologized, but people were shocked, not just because he seemed to blame the victims, but because the statement is so at odds with the beliefs of modern-day Japanese.
They know about tectonic plates. They know about geography, geology. They know why tsunamis happen, and they don't need some governor to say that it's the will of heaven that this happened.
John Nelson, an expert on Asian religions at the University of San Francisco, says Japanese society is largely secular, and yet events frequently drive them back to ancient traditions.
There's a famous saying in Japanese that people turn to the gods in times of trouble. And I think we'll see that here.
The rituals of Shinto and Buddhism permeate Japanese life. And in these two belief systems, scholars say, people do not focus on why the tragedy happened, but on how they should proceed. Duncan Williams is a Buddhist priest who just returned from Japan.
We can't pinpoint exactly what brought this about. I think the takeaway is that for Buddhists, it almost doesn't matter what caused this situation. What's important is the response.
Such as showing patience, resilience, and self-sacrifice in the face of tragedy, Williams says, and memorializing the dead. Ian Reeder, a professor of Japanese studies at Britain's University of Manchester, says when honoring their loved ones, most Japanese turn to Buddhist rituals, where priests read scripture and chant sutras before the body is cremated.
The general perception is that you do need rituals to be done to help the passage of the spirit from the living realm of the living to the realm of the dead, and also to separate the spirit from this realm.
And if those rituals are not performed, says Brian Bocking, an expert on Asian religions at University College Cork in Ireland, bad things can happen.
A spirit of an ancestor who's not properly memorialized can cause problems, you know, problems in the family, in the home, in the business and so forth, because they're unhappy, they're not being looked after properly.
So, what if a body or thousands of bodies have been washed out to sea? Bocking and others say Buddhist priests can hold mass memorials for the dead, and they are likely to do so in the next few days. After the funerals, when people begin rebuilding their homes and their lives, Shinto will move center stage. If Buddhism deals with death in Japan, Shinto deals with life. At the center are kami, life forces that are a little like deities and are ever-present.
The deities have two faces.
John Nelson says one face is benevolent, where deities help people in their day-to-day lives.
But those same deities have this wrathful side, which can also manifest itself at unpredictable moments.
And people turn to Shinto priests and rituals, he says, to restore the balance between the human and the divine. The Japanese appeal to Shinto deities at the beginning of things, the birth of a child, a wedding, a new home, a new car. Professor Brian Bocking says Japanese companies send delegations to Shinto shrines, and many have their own shrines.
And this is not because all the employees are devout followers. It's just that everyone in Japan knows that, well, there's all sorts of things that could happen in life. And, you know, why not get the gods on your side? I mean, they might not even exist, but if they do, then you might as well invoke them.
Which is what the Japanese will be doing as they cope with a tragedy not seen in a generation. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.